On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
You're going to find out about the media someday, folks. They are the worst.
So I can twist myself into pretzels trying to fit into their silly little box, or I can be who I am.
Are you and the media prepared to allow us to engage in that serious debate? Or do I have to get media attention by simply making reckless attacks on Hillary Clinton or anybody else? I don't believe it.
The questions that have been asked so far in this debate illustrate why the American people don't trust the media.
It may be popular for presidential candidates to bash the lamestream media, but Donald Trump actually owes us a big thank you. During his campaign, he's had so much media attention, he's hardly had to spend any money on advertising, but now he wants an apology. At a rally in Alabama on Saturday, he said this.
I watched when the World Trade Center came tumbling down, and I watched in Jersey City, New Jersey, where thousands and thousands of people were cheering.
Well, fact-checking has determined that that did not happen. But will these negative media stories hurt him or help him? Here to talk about this is Tom Rosenstiel. He's the executive director of the American Press Institute. That's a think tank on the future of the news media. Welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
Well, so usually when the media finds out that a candidate has stretched the truth, the candidate either apologizes or tries to amend the statement, walk it back in some way, and that hasn't happened in this most recent case with Donald Trump. So what does that tell you in terms of the media and the candidate?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on. The first one is that you've got so much media out there now that people are able to sort of choose their channels. And while this doesn't happen quite to the degree that people think, it does happen in politics. You know, ESPN is sort of a roadblock on national sports, and everybody is there. But when it comes to politics, people are self-selecting their sources a great deal more. And so you can attack the media, and people have in mind some other media than the one they're using. And so this works. The other factor is that Trump at this point is, even though leading in the polls, still represents a relatively small minority of people who are supporting him. If you're at 30% of primary voters in early states, you're probably at about 8% of the public that's actually supporting you, which this is an estimate from 538 in a piece yesterday. So you don't have to say, look, I'm being presidential. You can be pretty rad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what you're saying basically is that his supporters may not be actually reading the stories or listening to the stories that are fact-checking Donald Trump.
Yeah, there's a sort of congressional kind of effect when you ask people about trust in media. They'll say, yeah, I don't. We did this when I was at the Pew Research Center. We asked people, do you think the media get the facts right most of the time? And 60% said no. And then we said, what about the media that you use most? And 60% said yes. When we asked people, who do you have in mind when you think of the media, they thought of cable. And when you asked, who do you have in mind when you think of the media you use, they tended to think of local media, particularly broadcast.
Okay, so these news outlets are fact-checking Trump, and some of them even calling him a liar, especially when it comes to this Muslim comment that we just played. But at the same time, he is a creature of the media. So does the media have the power here, or does he have the power? In other words, since the media made Trump, can it unmake him?
Yeah. There was a time when the media had that power to a greater degree, although, as you said in your intro, bashing the media that is promoting you is a time-tested campaign technique. But today, we're long past the time when four or six TV channels and the AP and the New York Times and a handful of others could dictate the terms of the how you were portrayed in the media. When Michael Deaver, in 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected president, Michael Deaver told me in an interview later that there were 9 outlets that they cared about, and if they got those 9 outlets, they reached the country. That number is, I don't know, 9,000 now, certainly 900 at least. So it is, in that sense, a seller's market. The power has tipped to the newsmaker and away from the buyer, the news media. It really wouldn't matter what 5 or 6 even major outlets did. Trump could essentially create content by doing an event, and it would get out to the people that he wanted to reach. When you go to a campaign event, there's a pool camera for national television, and then there's probably 50 or 60 bloggers and local media, and many of them niche. That's the long tail, and the long tail is long.
So yesterday, a group of the heads of some of the major news organizations, like the networks, got together to see if they could wield their power in terms of how their correspondents are treated by the Trump campaign. I think there was some concern that they were being prevented from interviewing supporters or protesters and being controlled too much. And these the heads of these news organizations couldn't decide on what to do, and so they basically did nothing. And I guess it's just going to be business as usual. So does that illustrate what you're talking about?
Yeah, it also illustrates the mindset of media, which are, you know, they're sort of independent by nature, and it's always been herding cats. But you can go back to the 1960s. I remember when I was a young reporter, Jack Nelson, who was the Washington bureau chief of the LA Times when I was there, saying, covering George Wallace. And George Wallace would say, there is the national media back over there, and they'd, you know, and everybody would turn, and they said, they are going to lie to you. And there's Jack Nelson of the Los Angeles Times. And, the, you know, and it was sort of a threatening atmosphere, Jack would recall. And then later, Wallace, you know, when they were on the bus, would tease them. And, you know, they were, he needed them, and he was exploiting them, and they knew it, and he was pretty upfront about it.
So we've been talking about conservatives, George Wallace and Donald Trump. What about on the left? I mean, we played a little clip at the top of Bernie Sanders complaining about the media. Is there a similar complaint on the left?
Yeah, because when you're a candidate who's not a centrist establishment candidate, you are basically talking about things being wrong with the system. The parties are, you know, aren't talking about these things. The moneyed interests aren't talking about these things. And the media are part of that center establishment. It plays well to your base. If Trump were to win the nomination, typically he would, if he played to sort of historical type, a party nominee wouldn't do that, particularly in the summer when they really sort of need media. In the general election, when you see a candidate start to attack the media, that's usually a red light in the cockpit that something's wrong with the campaign. So, for instance, in 92, George H.W. Bush, who had very good relations with the press as a president and as a candidate generally, started having these bumper stickers, annoy the media, reelect Bush. And even Bush, who as a president was the most accessible, had more press conferences than any other president since John Kennedy, became very inaccessible in the campaign because, you know, there's just too much danger of saying the wrong thing. You're exposed all the time. You're not actually the president. You're out there pressing the flesh. And it's a kind of there's no good can come of it if you were to slip up.
Yeah. Well, can you talk about the financial incentive as well to cover someone like Donald Trump? Because obviously he is great for ratings, which means advertising dollars. And how do those concerns bleed over onto the journalistic side if they do?
Yeah, that's a great question because, you know, there's always this dilemma in media of, do you give the people what they want or what you think that they should have? And in campaigns, particularly early, and we got to remember, we've got another year of this, and voters won't actually get involved until, you know, for another several weeks, more than a month, you have this chicken and egg problem, which is, in old newspaper parlance, Trump is great copy, or in television and digital, they know that if you do a Trump story, more people read it. It's good for ratings. He's ahead in the polls or doing well in the polls. The more provocative, he's the most provocative candidate, and the more provocative it is, the more he seems to spike up. So you cover him, and then you create him. There's an old phenomenon I've talked a lot about over the years, which is that the media exaggerate every phenomenon they observe. They amplify and become part of the phenomenon through the act of observation. And that really goes on with campaigns, particularly because, and this has also been true for a very long time, that the media tend to be like a cyclops. They tend to tell one story at a time. They can focus on one thing. They have one eye. And so it's Trump rising or Trump falling or Trump attacking Carson, or then it's a Carson week or a Carson few days, because you have this master narrative that people are following, and that seems to be the story. It creates a kind of coherence for the campaign, but it also creates this sort of simplistic exaggeration effect.
Tom Rosenstiel, Executive Director of the American Press Institute, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
All right. We want to hear from you. What do you think of this cyclops, the media coverage of the presidential campaign? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Well, the attention we lavish on today's politicians is one thing, but how much attention should we pay to the legacies of past leaders? Students at Princeton are demanding that Woodrow Wilson's name be taken off school buildings. Before becoming the country's 28th president a century ago, Wilson served as president of Princeton. Now the university has the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs and a dorm named in his honor. But some students say that with these tributes, Princeton is ignoring the ugly side of Wilson, specifically his racism. Jonathan Zimmerman is a professor of education and history at New York University, and he's here now to talk about that. Hi.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, let's start with why the students are protesting. What were Wilson's views on race specifically?
Well, Wilson was a chronic racist, even by the standards of his own time. Let's remember that, he was a Virginian and he was born around mid-century, and he inherited the racial and racist doctrines of that state in that time. But he brought them to Washington, D.C., a place that before he became president was relatively progressive on race because of the Civil Service Act. And so African Americans were hired and also promoted in a fairly colorblind fashion before Wilson got there. And what he did was two things. He immediately segregated the federal workforce. But even worse, probably, what he did was he demoted African Americans who had worked their way up through the civil service system into positions of power, because he was appalled at the idea of African American having power over a white person.
What were the reasons that he gave for doing that, for segregating the workforce?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, one of the things that he said was, you know, he felt that the government would be inefficient. He felt that people, namely white people, would be uncomfortable. But this wasn't the only reflection of Wilson's racism. You could see it on a domestic and an international front. Let's also remember that the first movie screened in the White House, we think, was D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, which was based on a book by a guy named Dixon, who was a friend of Woodrow Wilson. He screened the movie privately in the White House and then told somebody that he thought that the movie was like writing history with lightning, and it's all so shockingly true. And, of course, as I'm sure your listeners know, that really the theme of that book is that during Reconstruction, the federal government ceded the South to kind of childlike bestial blacks who raped white women until the Ku Klux Klan came riding out of the sunset to defend white womanhood and vanquish the African Americans. So, I mean, it was obviously hugely racist at its core, echoing some of the worst racial themes of our history. On the international front, I think it's important to note that at the Paris Peace Conference, which set up the League of Nations, Wilson blocked a Japanese proposal to include racial equality, quote-unquote, that term, in the covenant and the founding principles of the League of Nations. And lastly, it was under Wilson the United States occupied Haiti. And if you look closely at the rationale for the Haiti occupation, it was highly racial and racist. The idea was Haiti was a, quote, black republic, and the blacks of that republic really didn't have the capacity to govern themselves.
Wow, this is fascinating, because I think what we learn in our history books is that Wilson was a big progressive, right? He believed in a strong federal government, the League of Nations he put forth. He espoused doctrines that led to eventually public housing, Medicare, public transportation.
Absolutely.
You know, he believed in spreading democracy around the world. And so how do you reconcile these two sides of him?
But see, all these things, what you just described as the textbook version, is also true. And it strikes me that a real embrace with Wilson's legacy, with anybody's legacy, has to embrace both sides of these equations. Absolutely, Wilson was a racist, even by the standards of his time. But he also, like the other progressives, presided over, literally and figuratively, an enormous burst in the power and scope of the federal government in this country. And one of the important things the federal government did was it provided services and protections for people, I should say, including eventually minorities, who desperately needed them because of the inequalities that were created by industrial capitalism. So it strikes me that we should be able to acknowledge both of these things in the same breath instead of simply emphasizing one side of the equation.
Okay, so if you could comment then on what you think should happen at Princeton in this particular case. I mean, do you think the names should be removed from these buildings?
Well, look, I think, first of all, that's up to people in the Princeton community, and I'm not a member of that. I will say that as a historian, I'm troubled with the idea of scrubbing names from anything. And the reason I'm troubled by it is I think the names spawn conversation. In fact, I would argue that what we're doing right now is an illustration of that. If Wilson's name isn't on the Wilson School and isn't on the Wilson College, we're not talking. So I think the most important thing is conversation. And it strikes me that the deal that was struck between the students sitting in and the president was exactly the right one. It wasn't a commitment to remove the names. It was a commitment to have a conversation about it. Mm-hmm. And if I were a member of the Princeton community, I would probably vote to retain the names precisely so we continue to discuss this history.
Well, is this akin to the Confederate flag discussion that we had earlier this year?
Well, I would argue it's more akin to the Confederate statues, and I would distinguish the two of them. Because, you know, it strikes me that in the case of the Confederate flag, what you have is an icon that was actually seized upon by white supremacists in the 1950s and 1960s to justify segregation. The Confederate flag was actually a minor piece of Southern iconography until the Civil Rights era, when it became a major one as a form and a symbol of so-called massive resistance. So I would distinguish that from Wilson. I don't really think there's an analogy there. Instead, what I would analogize it to are the debates about whether, say, to take down statues of Jefferson Davis or Robert E. Lee. And there, I think, you have a very good analogy. And again, as a historian, I would be loath to do that because, like it or not, these people, in all of their complexity and all of their inconsistencies, are a part of our shared history. And if we start taking away their images and their statues and their names, we're going to distance ourselves from that history instead of actually examining and embracing it.
Great to talk to you.
Thanks a lot. It was fun.
That's Jonathan Zimmerman. He's a professor of education and history at NYU. Well, should Princeton remove Woodrow Wilson's name from its buildings and institutions? Let us know what you think at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how Adele's new album is breaking all sales records and what that says about the music industry next on Press Play.
T take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry, you can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Hello, it's me.
Adele's new album, called 25, has broken the music industry's record for most albums sold in a single week. And the week is barely halfway through. Adele's album, released on Friday, has already sold more than 2 million copies. Only one other album has done that since Nielsen began tracking sales in 1991. And that was NSYNC's No Strings Attached, released in 2000. Joining me to talk about this is Chris Malamphy. He writes about music and the pop charts for Pitchfork, Slate, NPR Music, and others. Welcome.
Hey, how are you?
Well, I'm great. So the predictions are all over the map. They keep changing. But what are the latest estimates for how much 25 will sell?
They keep changing because they keep going up. As we entered into this tracking week, which started on Friday when, 25 was released and the bean counters over at Nielsen started counting, everyone expected the album to do over 1 million in a week. That was a very safe bet. The question going in was, could it do over 2 million? We have not seen any album do over 2 million since, as you pointed out, 2000, when NSYNC did it. They sold 2.4 million copies, to be exact, of their album No Strings Attached. That has already been handily beaten. We got numbers yesterday that it had reached about 2.3 million, which basically said that the NSYNC number was within sneezing distance. And as of today, this is very unusual, by the way. Nielsen does not normally provide day-by-day updates in the middle of a tracking week. But we just heard again from Nielsen that the album has topped 2.4 million and has topped the NSYNC total, which means that we still have about 3 days to go. The tracking week doesn't end until Thursday. And it's now anybody's guess how high this album sales week could go. It could quite possibly reach 3 million.
Why are single week sales so important?
Single week sales are, first of all, they're what determines what's number one on the charts. You know, single week sales make the headlines, and that's what gets broadcast everywhere and what affects the Billboard charts, both the Hot 100, which is its singles chart, and the Billboard 200, which is its album chart. However, you're right to ask the question, you know, is this important? Because it's not where you start, it's where you finish when it comes to an album. We've had albums that open to 1 million copies and then peter out at 3 or 4 million. Adele is coming off an absolute blockbuster, her 2011 album, 21, which has sold over 11 million copies since its release in early 2011. That is a staggering number for the modern music industry. Albums don't sell over 10 million copies anymore. But what's remarkable about 21 is that she never sold over 1 million copies in a week. 21 was a slow and steady, I wouldn't say slow because it sold very, very well, but it was just a week after week performer. It was sitting in the top 10 for the better part of 2 years. It never sold more than about 750,000 copies in a week, and that was only the week after it won the Grammy. But most weeks it would sell anywhere from, let's say, 100,000 to 300 or 400,000 copies, but little by little it made its way to 10, 11 million copies. So this opening week is very impressive, but it'll be interesting to see what 25, her new album, does down the stretch.
And is that just because people know her, they know her from the album 21?
Absolutely. I mean, I often say that the first week sales of any album, regardless of the artist, is a referendum on the artist's last album.
Uh-huh.
This is a pretty routine truism in, frankly, the entertainment industry in general. You find that sequels sometimes open bigger than the original movie did. You'll find that, you know, later chapters of a hit book series will sell better in their first week than the initial book did. And that is absolutely true of albums. Basically, people are all flooding in week one of Adele's album because Adele is the ultimate known quantity. Everybody knows what they're going to get. They love her. And with this album, she has delivered something that is absolutely in her wheelhouse, and everybody wants to own it.
And the interesting thing here is people owning it, right? Because
right.
The trend is to stream music, but people yeah. actually want to own this. Why?
Well, for starters, they have to right now. Adele made a somewhat controversial decision, though not unprecedented, to withhold the album from the major streaming services. We're talking about Spotify. We're talking about Apple Music, the part of Apple that doesn't sell stuff but streams stuff. You cannot stream 25 right now, even if you want to. She frankly waited until right up to the last minute to decide whether or not she was going to release it to the streaming services. But like Taylor Swift a year ago, she ultimately decided, at least for now, that she wanted people to acquire and hear the album in toto. But you are also correct that it's remarkable anyway, even if she had released it to the streaming services, I dare say with the kinds of numbers we're seeing, there's no doubt in my mind that she would have sold 1 or 2 million copies easily or quite a bit more. Adele is the kind of artist that people want to own. She is the exception to a lot of rules. We've only been in the streaming era, in this country for about 3-4 years. Spotify has been in America since 2011. But despite that, Adele is somebody who just routinely sells albums. 4 years after its release, 4.5 years after its release, 21 is still routinely among the top 200 best-selling albums of the week, often the top 100, because people want to own Adele.
Well, what is it about her? She is a pop star. How is she different from other pop stars, different from the Taylor Swifts, the Katy Perrys?
I guess we have to say that it starts with that voice and, you know, the perceived, and I use this word very advisedly, the perceived authenticity of Adele. I wrote in a piece for Slate recently talking about Hello, the lead single from the new album, that the authenticity thing and the differences people perceive in Adele are sometimes just a matter of perception. Because the fact is, Adele works with many of the same people that Katy Perry, Taylor Swift, many of the big pop stars of the day work with. She's also a 27-year-old. She's, you know, not much older than Taylor Swift, and she's actually younger than Katy Perry. So she is very much of the moment in the sense that she works with people like Greg Kurstin, the guy who co-wrote her current hit, Hello, or Max Martin, the pop Svengali, who's behind so many of the hits we've heard in the last 15 years, including Taylor Swift's and Britney Spears. So she works with all these people, but she brings something different to the table. Obviously, there's that voice, which is stronger than any of the people I've talked about thus far. And it's a sensibility. It's something that is appealing to your mom as much as it is to, the younger listener. She really has that 8 to 80 appeal that so few pop stars can really claim these days.
We've been talking about how many albums she sold and these records and stuff. But in terms of an artist, is she groundbreaking as an artist?
I mean, the artist I would compare her to, just in terms of her exceptionality, is Michael Jackson. They may not seem to have much in common. His was, you know, up-tempo dance pop, R&B based, and she's a torch balladeer. But in terms of where they sit at their moment in pop culture, Adele is absolutely the Michael Jackson of this decade, certainly in terms of sales. Thriller, which, of course, is the best-selling album of all time, was the number one album of both 1983 and 1984. And, you know, there was a time in America where it felt like everybody you knew owned a copy of Thriller. 21, Adele's prior album, is the Thriller of this decade. It was the number one album of 2 consecutive years. It continues to sell regularly. It spun off many hits, much the way Thriller did. And in terms of where they sit in popular culture, Adele is this kind of universal figure. You know, what Michael Jackson achieved in the 80s was he was a centrist at a time who drew everybody into this, you know, binding force of pop. And that's Adele now. She is the artist for her time, the ultimate pop act who draws everybody from, you know, grandmas to kids. And, you know, she even scores hits that, you know, teenagers will hear on top 40 radio. That's a pretty rare and exceptional thing.
So what do you think? Did you like that song, Hello? Do you like this new album?
I like Hello. To me, it feels like kind of a 45 or 90 degrees to the left shift of a prior single of hers, the hit ballad from 2011, Someone Like You. Someone Like You was a fairly remarkable record at the time. It was the first piano and vocal only number one hit in Billboard Hot 100 history. It had no drums. It was very stark. It sounded like nothing else on the radio. And Hello very much feels to me like a sequel to that. It's yet another song where Adele is singing about a former lover who won't speak to her anymore. There are some tweaks in the lyric. Obviously, this time Adele is the party apologizing, whereas in Someone Like You, she was the one feeling wronged. But other than that, we're still talking about two songs that are very much in the same pocket. But, you know, she manages to bring a lot of new things to the table. There are drums on this record. It's more booming. It's got a killer chorus, a totally belt-worthy chorus. You even saw Saturday Night Live having some fun with it this past weekend, talking about how every member of the family at the Thanksgiving table wants to belt out that chorus to Hello. So
to take.
so it's a perfect comeback record in a sense, because it feels just new enough, but it won't seem like a radical departure from what people have come to know of Adele in the past.
Chris Malamphy writes about music and the pop charts for Pitchfork, Slate, NPR Music, and others. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Well, Adele may be matching Michael Jackson's chart impact, but will she have the same artistic legacy? Let us know your thoughts on Facebook at KCRW Press Play, or give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, the studios love making disaster movies, but they never figured the cataclysm could hit so close to home.
In 1999, you know, I remember I was waiting for Y2K to happen, and then nothing happened. It struck, yeah, about 14 years later for Sony.
Every corner of Sony was affected by that hack. Amy Pascal lost her job as studio chief, and the lives of everyday employees were altered too. Sony, a year after the hack, after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 1 year ago today, everything changed at Sony. The entertainment company was hacked, probably by North Korea in retaliation for that Seth Rogen movie, The Interview. The computers in the office didn't work. Troves of data disappeared. Things like salary information and internal phone numbers compromised. And most notably, an avalanche of leaked emails between top executives and Hollywood names like Angelina Jolie and Aaron Sorkin went live online. The media, of course, had a field day. But for the rank-and-file employees at Sony, the days after that hack were harrowing. Slate staff writer Amanda Hess talked to many low and mid-level employees for her latest piece on the Sony hack. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, take us back to that day of the hack a year ago. What happened in the morning when employees arrived at the lot?
So they drove onto the lot, which is, you know, like many studios, fashioned as a fake small town with this sunny disposition and a big rainbow that reaches all across the parking lot. And they got there and security was beefed up. They were told in one way or another to not turn on their computers. And then they were just given confusing instructions like, first, just don't turn on your computer, then unplug it from the wall, unplug the internet, unplug the power source.
Unplug the internet.
Yeah. Any way that your computer is connected to any other computer, unplug that. And so every system that anyone who worked at Sony was using, except for the landline phones, which you could manually dial someone if you knew their phone number, were down.
But you couldn't look up anyone's phone number on the internet.
Right. And usually people would do was, you know, pick up the phone and use the phone directory to figure out how to dial someone in a different office. But even that was down. So if you didn't have someone's direct number, it was impossible to contact them unless, of course, you went over and talked to them in person.
And how many employees are we talking about?
On the lot, it's a few thousand. In total, it's about 7,000 people.
So I guess there were a lot of face-to-face meetings.
I heard that, you know, Sony's attempts over the past few years to become a green office sort of went out the window in the first few weeks after the hack, because everything was first a handwritten note. There were a lot of post-its to let people know what they were even supposed to do for their jobs, when meetings might be, just how to sort of like get the gears back in motion. Mm.
So, you know, we remember all the warnings for Y2K, and it was, yeah. Was it kind of like a mini Y2K come to pass that,
you know, I had the exact same thought that this was something that in 1999, you know, I remember I was, early in high school and I was waiting for Y2K to happen. And then nothing happened. It struck, yeah, about, you know, 14 years later for Sony. We're really nothing was online for quite a while. You know, systems, even, you know, stretching into the new year, there were some systems that just weren't working at all, that they had to push off their quarterly earnings report because their computers just weren't working. So now it's mostly back, but not 100%.
So in those early days, right after the hack, was there a kind of communal us versus them mentality, kind of one of those feelings of this is a disaster, let's all band together and try to get over this together?
Yeah, what I heard from many people was that they were all put in this strange boat together and set up on this journey that made them really build bonds with each other. Particularly the instant surge in face-to-face communication was sort of, you know, in this day and age, strange and helped to, you know, build emotional bonds with each other. I think no one at that point could understand just how long everything would stretch on for. What one person told me was they'd gotten this job out of college, and it was a job that they had thought that they would have for a few years, but their social security number is something that they need for their entire life, and that now is on the black market. Nobody knows how many people, you know what their social security number is. That is an event that could come back and haunt them for literally for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. So all that information, health insurance, life insurance information, that was all hacked. Even the identities of dependents of Sony employees. So, you know, a child's social security number potentially up for sale to the highest bidder on the black market.
Yeah. And the personal information of children, I learned while researching this story, can be particularly vexing to keep safe because, you know, for me as an adult, like I have a credit score that I can check in on periodically when I'm signing up for a new apartment or signning up for a new credit card. But kids don't have apartments and credit cards. So if you're not careful, it can be many years until you even discover that their personal information has been used by thieves.
So we heard a lot of information from these hacked emails, and it was, you know, delicious gossipy information about, you know, what executives thought of each other and thought of high-priced celebrities like Angelina Jolie and all that. But meanwhile, what kind of information was the rank and file receiving? What kind of help were they getting from their management?
Initially, after the hack, Sony set up a few different ways for employees to get help. There was a hotline that they could call to talk about issues with identity theft. There were psychological counselors who were put on the campus for a few weeks for people to talk to. But, you know, for a lot of people that I talked to, it was sort of like the damage had been done. You know, you can't put the social security number like back in the box.
Right. Because I remember a lot of complaints that Sony could have had better security in place, better e-security in place and didn't.
Yeah. So, you know, when you think about the Sony hack, you think of something that is totally unprecedented that no one could prepare for. So if you ask Sony, they'll say that 90% of companies would have fallen to the tactics that the hackers used. The FBI and a security firm that Sony hired after the hack have backed that up. But if you ask 100 different security researchers, I think you'll get 100 different opinions about what Sony could have done. And Sony, you know, for many years has been a favored target among hackers because of certain decisions that Sony has made in terms of hunting down pirated content and securing its PlayStation network. They've been on hackers' radars for a while.
And what about all the lawsuits that were filed in the wake of this, lawsuits against Sony by employees?
No current employee filed suit against Sony, but many ex-employees filed suit because in the stores of information that were leaked in the wake of the hack, there were many, many ex-employees affected by those. When I spoke with current employees, you know, many of them told me that they were kind of grossed out by the speed with which lawyers descended on them, asking them to join a class action suit. And also, one thing that I was told over and over again was even though Sony has 7,000 employees, that Hollywood is still run like a small town. And if you have your name show up in Variety because you joined a class action lawsuit against your employer, there were some people who were worried that that might impact their career going forward and that no other studio might be super excited about hiring someone mm-hmm. who sued their last employer.
So what did they offer? What did they get out of it, the employees, at the end of the day from Sony?
So after all of the ex-employee lawsuits were consolidated into a class action suit, that was settled last month, and Sony ended up paying about $3.5 million to the lawyers who brought the suit, and another several million to cover various costs that people had incurred to protect their data. And Sony also paid for AllClear, which is a credit protection service, for all employees, ex-employees, and dependents through 2017.
And that's the result of the lawsuit, or they did that on their own?
On their own, Sony paid for a year of AllClear for current employees. After the lawsuit was settled, they extended that offer to ex-employees and to dependents for, you know, about 3 years. So at the end of 2017, people will be on their own and have to decide, you know, how much they're willing to pay out of pocket to protect their credit going forward.
All right. So a year later, what's the culture like now there? Are people still, are they feeling wary about sending emails, about electronic communications, about their personal information?
Surprisingly, no. Most of the people I talked to said, you know, in terms of how they communicate, it's almost exactly the same. Michael Linton, who heads up Sony, told me that he is consistently shocked by emails that he gets from people saying things that he knows they wouldn't want to see on Gawker or on BuzzFeed. Even after an incident like this, it's hard to change your habits. And also it's impossible to, you know, change the habits of everyone else that you have to work with, you know, in your big wide industry in order to get your business done.
Amanda Hess, staff writer for Slate, where she writes about the internet. Thanks, Amanda.
Thanks for having me.
And more on All News in the House now to give us a preview of To the Point, coming up at 1 o'clock.
We are going to go take a look at the Mexican border. You know, we keep hearing again and again that what we need is a big, beautiful wall on the Mexican border. Turns out the security is probably stronger than it's ever been on the Mexican border. And this astonishing fact, there are more Mexican immigrants now going south to Mexico than there are Mexican immigrants coming north into the United States. We'll talk about why that is. There also, it's of course a very complicated place, and there's also another surge of Central American children that were anticipated. But we'll hear too about what it's like to live on the border, how the people there feel about the changes that are taking place. One person says it used to be very different, a lot of socializing going back and forth across the border. And of course, Mexicans are absolutely crucial to the economy of some of the American border towns. It's a really interesting story.
Oh, fascinating. A deep dive at the border. Thank you very much, Warren Olney, and To the Point. So stick around for that at 1 o'clock. And coming up before that, how movies get made. Is it sometimes just someone doing someone else a favor? That apparently was the case with Angelina Jolie's latest movie. That story is next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You might have seen a trailer for a movie and thought to yourself, that looks terrible. How did that even get made? Well, the answer might be it was a favor. Studios often agree to throw a few million at a star's pet project in order to keep that star on board for more commercial movies later. Angelina Jolie's new film, By the Sea, is an example of that. And the folks at The Hollywood Reporter are suggesting that the poor performance of that movie and some other recent high-profile passion projects might just have Hollywood looking again at this back-scratching. Matt Bellany is executive editor at The Hollywood Reporter, and he's a regular on The Business and The Hollywood Breakdown with Kim Masters right here on KCRW. Hi, Matt.
Hi there.
So By the Sea, starring Angelina Jolie Pitt and her husband, Brad Pitt, two of Hollywood's biggest stars, most bankable stars, and yet this movie has grossed what? About $300,000 so far?
Yeah, it's less than a million. It's like 300 and 35, something like that. It's a very, very low number, especially considering you've got two of the biggest movie stars in the world in it.
Yeah, yikes. So tell us the story of how this got made.
Well, this was a passion project of Angelina Jolie Pitt, who directed the film and is the co-writer as well. And, you know, she wanted to make this film very badly. And there are a lot of studios that would love to be in the Angelina Jolie Pitt business. When she stars in a major blockbuster tentpole style movie, such as Maleficent or Wanted or any of the big movies that she's done, she's one of the world's most bankable stars. But this is not that kind of project. And her artistic inclinations are to become more of a director and to do this kind of project. And Universal, which is hoping that she will be in the Universal family for years to come and make many big blockbuster style movies with them, very much wanted to do this movie with her to show that they are her creative partner. And whatever money they lose on this film is considered an investment in Angelina Jolie Pitt and her future.
So do they care much that they're going to lose a bunch of money?
Well, I don't think any studio likes to lose money, and there are examples in the past of these so-called relationship movies that end up doing well, and I don't think they anticipated it doing this poorly, but I don't think in the grand scheme of things, for a studio that is making billion-dollar movies and billions of dollars off of franchises like Jurassic World and Minions and Fast and Furious 7, I don't think they care that they'll lose, you know, $30, $40 million on this movie.
And is there a definite quid pro quo? I mean, is it spelled out that if we give you this money, you will star in our next big blockbuster, our next Maleficent?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that's the risk, is that you're dealing with creative people here and you're dealing with people with very sophisticated representatives. You know, there is kind of an unwritten rule you hear about, the one for me, one for you principle, where people like Michael Bay, who's a very successful director of the Transformers franchise, he a couple years ago wanted to do a smaller movie about bodybuilding called Pain and Gain. And the studio said, okay, you've made us billions of dollars on the Transformers franchise. We're going to let you go off and make this movie that may not be a commercial type movie, but if it's going to help convince you to be involved in Transformers 4, then maybe that's worth it as an investment. And that's exactly what happened.
So how often does this happen? Because there was also the Sandra Bullock movie, Our Brand is Crisis, also a flop and a favor movie. How often does this happen?
I think it's happened throughout the history of Hollywood, where, you know, stars are become bankable for studios in one context, but their artistic ambitions may lead them in another direction. So there's a tug of war that goes on between what the star is creatively interested in doing and what the studio needs them to do in order to make a lot of money. So for instance, with Our Brand is Crisis, which stars Sandra Bullock and was produced by George Clooney, Bullock and Clooney were the stars of Gravity for Warner Brothers, which made a lot of money. And they very much want to be in the Sandra Bullock and George Clooney business. Specifically, there is an Ocean's 11 reboot that Warner Brothers would like to do, starring a female cast. And they would very much like Sandra Bullock to be the anchor of that cast and for George Clooney to produce that movie. Now, Warner Brothers allowing them to go off and make Our Brand is Crisis, which is not a an automatic successful movie. That is an investment Warner Brothers is making in that relationship. And they basically said as much. We cherish our relationship with Sandra Bullock, the studio's marketing head said.
Well, isn't there some kind of questioning then of the bankability of stars to sell tickets, the power of their name and their likeness to sell tickets? Because if they're not selling tickets to these movies, then what does that say about them?
Yeah, I mean, this whole practice comes into greater focus when you consider the ecosystem today in Hollywood, where stars are less bankable and they're less of an automatic draw. It's not just, you know, you can't just put Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt in a movie and have it be an automatic sell. There are things you can do to help that, the kinds of movies you make and the different types of franchises, plus a star that can really be successful. But, you know, something like By the Sea, if you looked at the posters for that movie, you don't see Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie Pitt. You see two hats. And that was a very specific choice that we're told Angelina Jolie was very adamant about, that they not sell this movie based on their faces and their images. That's a big problem for a studio that's trying to market a movie worldwide if you can't put the two most famous people in the world on the poster. But that's what she wanted.
Hats.
hats.
Why hats?
Yeah, it's a very the tone of the movie is very art house, European 70s style romantic drama, and she felt that you know, it best represented the tone of the movie.
So maybe they should just take their passion project somewhere else, to like an indie film house, which, you know, critics might look at it like, oh, okay, it's not coming from Sony, it's coming from this, it's coming from Magnolia or something. They might look more kindly on it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the argument here. There is a market for smaller indie-style movies that don't get giant studio marketing budgets and don't get the full backing of the studio, and perhaps some of these passion projects would be better suited for those, you know, smaller divisions, many of which are owned by the big studios, but they get a different type of release. But what you're seeing here in these two examples, this Angelina Jolie movie, By the Sea, was a Universal Pictures release. Our Brand is Crisis was a Warner Brothers release. These were big studios taking on projects that perhaps were better suited for the smaller indie arms because they wanted to be in the business of those stars.
Matt Bellany, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Matt Bellany is executive editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Hello. Jolie Myers, not Angelina Jolie.
She says it wrong. Jolie. The most controversial thing we did on the show today, according to listener comments.
Yeah.
Adele.
Really?
I know.
I thought, like, she was a crowd favorite.
I thought literally everyone had bought her album.
Almost.
And by literally, everyone. I mean figuratively. no, on Twitter, Chad says that the report that we did was exhausting and irrelevant, and he actually spells Adele's name wrong, and he says it's on purpose out of disrespect for the artist.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Chad is not a fan. Mm. Matthew Adam Ward says that Adele's release is classic major label PR machine brainwashing. So apparently millions and millions of Americans have been brainwashed by the company that puts out Adele's album. But over on Facebook, Penny Gunyon says that the comparison of Adele to Michael Jackson, actually a pretty good one, but she would say more like Barbara Streisand in the 70s. She's a big fan. We had lots of other big fans on Facebook.
All right. Thank you very much, Jolie Myers. If you want to weigh in, please do on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney, To the Point, up next at 1 o'clock. So keep it right here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a fantastic afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.